Our next case of the morning is number 07-1445, Harp against Charter Communications. Ms. Wolf.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Fern Wolf, and I represent Mary Harp, the appellant in this, a Sarbanes-Oxley case. Mary Harp is a former employee of Charter Communications, which is the cable company in the St. Louis area, which includes parts of southern Illinois. Charter fired Mary Harp because she was interfering with Charter's ability to pay hush money to a minority contractor called MISTA, which had threatened to expose a minority fronting scheme in which Charter was involved. Harp knew that MISTA was threatening Charter. Charter paid the money, and so Charter fired Harp so it could get away with paying the money to MISTA and buy MISTA's silence so that MISTA would not go to the city of St. Louis and expose the minority fronting scheme, a scheme which Charter has yet to deny existed. Charter insists that it has clear and convincing evidence that it fired Harp because it had a legitimate need to cut expenses.
Well, let's go into that for a moment, because would it really be a reasonable inference for a jury to find that 50 people were laid off, including the entire auditing department, as well as approximately 25 more people from other areas, basically in an effort to terminate one person?
Well, it would be a reasonable inference, and it is Charter's burden to prove it by clear and convincing evidence, but in any event, it would be a reasonable inference for a couple of reasons. Number one, there was no other reason for the reduction. There are different stories that Charter has told, but because they are so wildly inconsistent, and ultimately, when Charter came up with the amount that it had to save by March 31st, 2004, which was $2.4 million, the numbers just didn't add up. They saved, if anything, about $165,000, but then they paid it all in severance. So they saved no money. So we know that it wasn't to save money, and we know they lied about it. And a lie about a reason would allow a jury to infer an unlawful motive. And furthermore, Charter had to get rid of Mary Harp, and it really needed to get rid of her entire department, the entire audit department, because they were in on investigating MISTA and MISTA's fraudulent billing activities. And just before the January 12th meeting with MISTA, Mary Harp's department had discovered that Charter had not even gone to one of the places that it submitted some of these fraudulent invoices on. So not only were these invoices double invoices or photocopies of other invoices, but they were fiction. MISTA had not even gone out and done the audit work at all.
Were any of the 75 people rehired?
It was about 50 people. Yes, some were rehired. I'm not sure what's in the record, but some were rehired. Actually, Mary Harp's termination paperwork says she was not eligible for rehire.
Was she the only one that had that notation on her termination paper?
Again, it's not in the record, but no, she was not the only one who had the notation on her paperwork. But it was on her paperwork, and which is inconsistent with Barry Wilson's, which was the head of Charter's operations in St. Louis, his email correspondence with Tom Baker, Mary Harp's new supervisor, saying, yeah, don't you remember we talked about bringing Mary Harp back on board when we first arranged doing this thing? But her paperwork said not eligible for rehire. Charter was keeping its options open. It didn't want to have to take Mary Harp back.
And when she was told about the termination, wasn't she sort of pulled aside?
Yes, she was separated. The rest of the group was meeting at the office where she worked, which is in Belleville, Illinois. And she was called to headquarters, which is in St. Louis. And she was pulled aside, offered a severance payment, and she said, you know, I know this is happening to me because of my complaints about Barry Wilson paying MISTA, and Brooke Wilson denied it, of course. And this is a little off topic. Brooke Wilson is the one that actually threatened Mary Harp with retaliation if she persisted in making the complaint and said, it's going to get ugly, nobody's 100%, there's not supposed to be retaliation. And then Brooke Wilson participated in the decision to get rid of Mary Harp.
I'll ask Charter, but I am wondering how many of the employees in the audit department were subsequently rehired.
Okay. I don't know exactly how many were rehired. I know that the second in command to Mary Harp, who had been included in on some meetings, which ordinarily only Mary Harp would have attended, as of January 20th, which shows how early the decision was probably made, he was rehired. And his name is Doug Henderson. And so he was rehired. And the fact that Tom Baker included Doug Henderson in on that meeting as of January 20th indicates that they were probably planning to get rid of her as of January 20th. Another aspect of it all is Charter has made up a story about when they made the decision that they had to get rid of these 50 people. At first, they told OSHA, which for some reason or another investigates Sarbanes-Oxley Act complaints, Charter told OSHA that the decision was made in January. Then, as the case progressed, they kept inching it farther and farther away from Mary Harp's protests, and then later on it became early February. Well, it had to be sometime before February 25th, which is the day she was fired, but I think they wanted to inch it away to make it appear that there was no temporal link between Mary Harp's January 14th protests and the decision to get rid of her, when in fact the evidence is that they plan to get rid of her right away. As soon as she made those protests, and particularly as soon as she said she was going to investigate other aspects of MISTA's involvement with Charter, which would have led her directly to the minority fronting scheme. Barry Wilson knew that by mid-January of 2004, that Charter's livelihood in the St. Louis area, which is where its headquarters was dependent on shutting MISTA up and shutting up everybody who was involved in the minority fronting scheme. And so Charter paid MISTA $165,000 for nothing, even though it documented a settlement, but there's an invoice attached to the settlement that accounts for most of the money, which is clearly false.
But doesn't the record reflect that she was repeatedly assured that MISTA would not, in fact, be paid for any work that it didn't perform, and that she would be allowed to pursue her investigation into the alleged discrepancies?
Yes, she was assured of those things, but she couldn't continue in her investigation because she was fired. So that was the ultimate way to terminate her investigation, was to get rid of her completely.
What would you say the timeline is then?
In terms of
her being, repeatedly assured.
In the fall and early winter of 2003, she was repeatedly assured that MISTA wouldn't get paid anything above what she approved, and she could investigate. And Barry Wilson was actually cooperative in it. But come January, something changed. And that is most likely when he found out about the fronting scheme. And so that by January 12th, Barry Wilson gave her lip service that she would be allowed to, for example, to look into MISTA's payroll records. And she was told, get with Hunt Brown about it. That's the in-house counsel. But she got with Hunt Brown about it, and he never gave her the payroll records. By the end of January, Barry Wilson sent her an email that was critical of her work performance, so that she had to stop working on the investigation. That really stopped it right there. And then she had to stop working on the investigation by the end of January, and she was fired, so there was no further investigation. And any investigation that continued to go on is just a charade, because Charter paid MISTA, and the payment had nothing to do with the audit. It had to do with this invoice 6000, which is a fictional invoice.
You know, I had a little problem that I hope you can help me with. Because the key factor in her belief that a fraud was being perpetrated, I believe, is that statement at page 3 of the reply brief, that Wilson abruptly ends the meeting with Davis and Harp and orders Baker to pay MISTA the full contract amount. But the cite in the brief doesn't appear to support that statement, the cite was Appendix 997, 956 at, page bottom of 314 to 315.
Actually, I'm looking in the reply brief, right? It's page 3 of the reply brief?
Yeah. And the question was, let's see.
I see where I'm. I guess before my rebuttal time, if I can look it up and try to figure out if it's a typo.
Okay, because I don't think it's a typo, because the question was, do you have any amount as to, was it the excess amount you didn't authorize? Was it the QC work? Do you have any idea what amount he was accruing for? I'm not talking about dollar amounts, but what was it, excess amounts that you didn't pay? And the answer is, I don't know. Okay, did Tom ever tell you in that conversation that Barry Wilson had instructed him or anyone else at Charter to pay the amounts due to Mr. Sowers? You mean other than what she's just said? Question by Ms. Lubin. Yes, all he said was he thought they were going to be paid. Did Barry Wilson tell him that they were going to be paid? Answer, I don't know.
I will look for that, because so, I do recall in the record that she said that Tom Baker told her that he thought he was supposed to pay the entire accrued amount on the contract, which was $500,000, the entire amount of the contract, which is $498,000.
See, so, the best possible inference, it seemed to me, from the cited deposition testimony is that she left that meeting confused as to what Wilson was going to do.
Except for when she asked Tom Baker for clarification, and Tom Baker told her that he thought that he was going to pay the entire accrued amount. And I'll try to find that during
the... Well, won't be able to listen to your...
I'll try to multitask here. But she did believe that he was going to pay the entire accrued amount, which was $500,000. And by the time she complained, she knew more than just what she knew when she left the meeting, which led to her reasonable belief, because she saw the email from Phyllis Shumpert Davis, where Phyllis Shumpert Davis said, before you exclude me as a contractor of this company, you better know some of the facts. And she exposed the entire minority fronting scheme.
Well, maybe instead of sitting time doing that, you could send it in an addendum.
I will. I will do that.
Because it would be terrible to just have you do that.
Anyway, so she knew not only what Barry Wilson said, but more importantly, she knew that Phyllis Shumpert Davis was threatening the company. When she made her first statement to Brooke Wilson, her first complaint, Brooke Wilson added to Mary Harp's knowledge by saying he has minority issues, he could lose the franchise. So it wasn't just the money. It could have been $10,000. It was losing the franchise on the specter of the criminal prosecutions against four Charter executives, which were going on at the same time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf. We'll hear now from Ms. Lubin.
May it please the Court, my name is Crystal Lubin, and I represent the Appalachian Charter Communications, Inc. In order for this Court to reverse Judge Reagan's grant of summary judgment, it must find, as Judge Rovner pointed out, that Charter Communications eliminated an entire department and instituted a 50-plus person reduction in force in order to retaliate against Ms. Harp.
Is counsel correct that, in fact, no money was saved by the termination of that department? Is there a genuine issue of triable fact on that question?
Sure. It is not. It is not. We did, in fact, Charter did save money. And let me briefly go through that with the Court. First, it's ludicrous to suggest that eliminating 50 positions would not result in any cost savings. What Ms. Wolf is alluding to is that the monthly salary savings would have been $166,000 from her law clerk's counting of what the severance payments or what the salary would have been for those people, and said the severance would have been $200,000. So obviously there's no cost savings. That's an incorrect analysis of accounting principles. A severance payment is a one-time charge that goes on a separate line and doesn't affect the balance sheet.
Yeah,
and
but forgive me for interrupting.
Of course.
But we have to look at what happens thereafter. You know, sometimes companies fire 50 people, and then they hire one, and they give, you know, just look at what you know, some of these people are making out there. You know, they hire one and it takes...
Sure. There was, in fact, cost savings. Barry Wilson's boss, Lee Clayton, would not approve it unless there was cost savings. There was cost savings. Barry Wilson testified he's not sure if he met the entire amount he was charged with, which was $800,000. However, but again, there was obviously... They eliminated 50 positions, and I believe, and Judge, we can also supplement this, but I believe there was only 5 to 10 individuals of that 50-plus that were eliminated that were actually rehired. They were hired in lower-level positions in which there was another position for them to do. Again, these guys are technical guys. They could go and install cable. They can hook up people. They can do anything. So there were a few that actually did apply and get other jobs. But the other thing you've got to keep in mind is that there were 50 positions eliminated. Obviously, there is cost savings that would have gone for those additional quarters if only 5 to 10 were hired back.
Why was she informed of the RIF separately? Why were the terms different for her? Why was she not eligible for rehire?
She was informed differently because she was the general manager for. She was the highest level position that was eliminated in the reduction in force. They brought her in to tell her that she was being eliminated for financial considerations as a courtesy to tell her about this. Her package was different because she was at a higher level than others.
Why ineligible to rehire, though?
Yes, that was a mistake. It is Charter's policy that anyone who's reduced in a reduction in force are eligible for rehire.
Well,
that was a mistake.
Forgive me now. Is that a jury question?
No, I don't think so, because there were other people who were also marked ineligible, and there's no evidence in the record that Mary Harp applied to come back for work. And so there was never reached the issue of whether or not she'd be rehired or not, but she would have been considered for other jobs.
Well, if you're told.
And in fact, Barry Wilson even suggested in an email that if they could reconstitute the audit function, she would be brought back in a different position. He testified that he never wanted to eliminate the audit department, but had to, because when he got the directive, and it's undisputed that there wasn't a directive from his supervisor that he had to make cuts. He had to get expenses in line with the revenue that was being generated. And there was no dispute that that directive came down. There may be on the exact day, and we said it was January. We then said it was late January, early February. There's no discrepancy between January and late January, early February. Undisputed that the directive came down after the preliminary numbers in January were actually released. And one other point really quick on the cost savings for this reduction in force. The line item for Charter's budget for the audit department, which, of course, as you guys understand, was only half of the reduction in force, was $1 million. Clearly, there was a cost saving in eliminating an entire department as well as 50 full-time positions. And you can't just look at the salary that was saved and the severance that went out, but there's a lot of other things that go on to the costs of that. Health care, overhead, uniforms, all of those things also figure into the cost savings when you eliminate an entire department.
Where in the record will we find this concrete evidence that there were savings?
Yeah. The audit, in the budget, the audit alone was $1 million item, and that's appellate. That's the record at 537.
I don't want to sound like a broken record, but as I noted earlier, you can save $1 million and then turn around within the next so many months and add $1.5 million. Who's doing the auditing now? I mean, how do you get rid of an entire auditing department?
Well, let me explain, and there may be some confusion. It was a technical audit department. And what the technical audit department does was send these guys out to check to see if people were stealing cable. They would go out and check the box to see if there were non-active subscribers who were hooked in that shouldn't be. They also would check for the active houses, meaning you get cable, but maybe you're not paying for those premium channels, and there's a way to check for that as well. And Mary Harp, in her sworn testimony, said that during her tenure at Charter, and then she worked for predecessor cable companies before that, there were times when there was no one who was charged with doing the technical audit function, let alone an entire department. So there are times with cable companies where there's no one is doing this because it is a luxury to have someone go out there and look. Again, the technical audit department was selected because it was the least customer-facing department out there. It didn't provide direct customer service, but rather looked for people who were stealing cable. And Mary Harp, in her sworn testimony, was unable to identify a single other department that was less customer-facing that should have been eliminated, which then goes to support that the reduction in force was a legitimate cost-saving measure that was instructed by Barry Wilson's supervisor to happen. And there's no evidence presented by Mary Harp to dispute that there was a directive giving to reduce expenses to match revenue. And in result, the technical audit department, along with other employees, 50-plus, were eliminated to address that. I do also want to touch on this whole issue of the uncovering of the minority fronting scheme with the city of St. Louis. There is absolutely no evidence in the record that there was any such minority fronting scheme. First, Mary Harp, it's undisputed that Mary Harp did not know about MISTA's relationships with its non-minority subcontractors and the purported minority fronting scheme during her employment. She testified that under oath.
You mean because she became aware of the potential fraud on the city later?
After the institution of this lawsuit, yes. She had, and she testifies it, and that's at the record 314, 324 to 325. She had no knowledge of any of this. She also testified she had...
Must have had a gut feeling of some sort. I mean, something's bizarre.
Well, not that she ever raised in any of her complaints to Charter. Her only complaints were that she thought it was wrong for Barry Wilson to terminate the meeting on January 12th and instruct his subordinate to negotiate a legitimate settlement to this contractual dispute. There is no dispute in the record that there was this legitimate contractual dispute. Mary Harp testified under oath that, yes, the contract was confusing and that there was a legitimate dispute between MISTA and Charter as to what was the scope of the contract. Should they audit active houses or not? In addition, Mary Harp's entire theory about this relationship with the city revolves around her belief that Charter was afraid it was going to lose its franchise with the city because it was not meeting the minority set-aside provision. Ms. Harp has no evidence for this proposition, and it's contradicted by the evidence in the record. As Jack Thomas, who was the person charged in the city of St. Louis with handling their minority business enterprises program, testified, set-aside provisions are a goal rather than a requirement because set-asides are legally problematic. And this court has held that as well in Builder Association of Greater Chicago versus the County of Cook. There is absolutely no evidence that Charter would have lost its franchise if it did not meet those minority set-aside goals. And in fact, the evidence in the record is that Charter frequently informed the city of the current status of Charter's use of minority firms and what percentage of the minority business enterprises work was being self-performed. In December of 2003, before Mary Harp makes her complaints, Charter informed the city that MISTA was only self-performing 22.5% of its work, well below the 30% of the self-performance threshold that the city requested. Jack Thomas of the City of St. Louis testified that the only circumstance in which it would be wrong for MISTA to use subcontractors would to be if the subcontractors were not disclosed. In the present case, it's undisputed that MISTA's use of subcontractors was disclosed to the city long before Mary made any complaints. And finally, if the reason for eliminating Mary Harp's job and that of 50 others was to keep Harp quiet about the issue with the city, why would Charter have continued to keep her involved in the dispute? It invited her to the meeting on the 12th and then instructed her along with Tom Baker to continue to investigate and repeatedly assured her that even after the meeting on January 12th that no money would be paid to MISTA for auditing work that had not been performed. And in fact, the record supports that that is what happened. There were no payments to MISTA for auditing work than what was approved and submitted by Mary Harp. This whole scenario of this invoice 6,000 does not carry water. Hunt Brown, the legal counsel who testified as a Rule 30b-6 and who was instrumental in resolving all of the issues with MISTA, testified that invoice 6,000 was in fact one where he looked at the work that was done on that invoice. It was specifically called for in the contract. And now this was a contract for construction work, not audit work. And he verified that that work should be paid for. We also submitted by the accounts payable person at Charter a declaration that said, here are the payments that were made to MIST for audit work. There is absolutely no evidence in the record that supports that MIST was paid for audit work other than what Mary Harp approved. This whole issue, there's nothing in there except plaintiff's supposition that somehow there was a made-up invoice and Charter went ahead and paid that for auditing work. There is nothing that supports that in the record. And in fact, Mary Harp testified that Hunt Brown, the person, the legal attorney who put this whole settlement together, had not done anything wrong and had never acted in the best interest of Charter. The other thing I want to touch on that Judge Rovner had brought up in her questions to Ms. Wolf is that in Mary Harp's brief, she asserts a reasonable person in Harp's situation could believe Wilson's behavior, stopping the presentation to instruct his suspiciously installed second-in-command to pay MISTA everything on the contract, was a fraud against Charter shareholders. Judge Rovner is right. That is not supported by the record. First, the evidence, including Mary Harp's own sworn testimony, belies the statement. She testified that when Barry Wilson terminated that meeting on January 12th, he never said to pay MISTA. He left the impression that MISTA would be paid more. In his conduct later, he continued to say, we will not pay MISTA for work that has not been performed. In addition, it was well known what the contract amount was, $498,000. Why would Barry Wilson tell Tom Baker, according to Mary Harp, get with Phyllis and figure out an amount to put this all behind us? The amount was known, $498,000. Why would he need to get with MISTA to determine that? In addition, Mary Harp indicated that by terminating the meeting early, Barry Wilson put Charter in a bad negotiating position. If the instruction was to pay everything on the contract, what was left to negotiate? And finally, the conduct after that was Barry Wilson said, get with Tom Baker, Ms. Harp, and lay out the claims chronologically and figure out what, if anything, needs to be paid to MISTA. And her email of January 14th to Barry Wilson said, Tom Baker has pulled a list of all the zip codes, clearly indicating they were still investigating and not going to pay MISTA for more work than what was already approved. It's also, let me just briefly make the point, that it's not objectively reasonable that settling a legitimate dispute in order to avoid litigation constitutes a fraud against one's shareholders. Construing Sarbanes in this matter would open up the floodgates to litigation and have numerous unintended consequences. For example, any public company which negotiated the settlement of a legal dispute would be at risk for Sarbanes-Oxley litigation if any employee objected to the settlement. I see my time is up. We would ask the court to please affirm both the discovery order and the grant of summary judgment in Charter's favor. Thank you.
How much time does Ms. Wolf have? Thank you.
Okay. Briefly, Lee Clayton testified, and it's at page 1117 of the record, that the salary cuts alone accomplished the entire goal of the directive. So any budget savings that Charter, any savings Charter had, like the $1 million for the audit department and uniforms and all that, that didn't count. Barry Wilson testified that he was supposed to, and Charter told OSHA that he was supposed to save $2.4 million by March 31st, 2004. At best, he saved 5 weeks' worth of salary, and 1 month of salary was $166,000. And those are the figures that count. And it's just a question of adding and subtracting and multiplying and dividing. The directive is so disputed because it wasn't in writing. If this was so important, my goodness, 50 people are being fired. There was not a single writing indicating that Barry Wilson needed to get rid of people. There's no writing to determine. There's not one piece of written evidence to show that there was ever a meeting to decide who to get rid of, and the directive is not in writing, which is really important. Mary Harp's knowledge when she protested was also based on Phyllis Shumper Davis's email threatening to go to the city, and Barry Wilson was scared that Phyllis Shumper Davis threatened to go to the city and expose the minority fronting scheme. Charter paid $400,000 in blackmail to the white-owned companies a few months afterwards. Surely Charter felt that it had done something wrong, and that's what Mary Harp uncovered, and that's why she was fired. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.